I'm going to talk to you about some common neurologic emergency cases, and I end up having to cut this down a little bit because I really wanted to focus the first part of this on head trauma, and then talk about a little bit about neurologic toxins. Neurologic emergencies in general commonly present to the emergency room. It's one of the four major emergency systems from my perspective. I think of it as the cardiovascular system, the respiratory system, the abdominal system, meaning the whole abdominal cavity, and then the neurologic system. In the emergency critical care world, I'd say that those are the four big things that we think of. So it's definitely something that we need to feel good about in diagnosing and stabilizing and treating these patients when you are an emergency doctor. So I'm going to focus on head trauma for the first part of this, and then a few select neurologic toxins towards the end. So on the head trauma subject, I'm going to talk a little bit about pathophysiology of head trauma, which is going to lead to the kind of combine with the approach to treatment. And then I have a slide on some future directions for treatment, whether or not they'll ever come to fruition, I don't know. And then a little bit on prognosis of the head trauma patient. So we're going to work through this with a case with this little kitty here that got hit by a car. He's a young adult, domestic short hair, male castrated. He was actually a stray and came in through the Humane Society. His mucous membranes were pale pink. He had prolonged capillary refill time at 3 seconds. He's tachycardic at 220 with weak pulses. He was tachypneic with normal to slightly increased breath sounds in all fields, and his abdominal palpation was normal. He had very depressed mentation. He was capable of responding, but his response was decreased, and he was non-ambulatory, and it was recumbent with intermittent extensor rigidity. And these things are going to become important when we're talking about prognosis, as is the cranial nerve exam, where he had some anisocoria, and his direct and indirect pupillary light reflexes were present but slow, and he was difficult to assess his menace, but he appeared to be visual bilaterally. All of his other cranial nerves were normal. He also had palpable skull fractures and a mandibular symphyseal fracture. So in this case, we really need to focus on what the life-threatening problems are. And in this situation, he's definitely in traumatic shock based upon his weakly palpable pulses, his tachycardia, his tachypnea, and even some of his mental and neurologic exam abnormalities very likely are due to the shock state, which is very important to recognize when we're talking about prognosis, because we can't determine the full neurologic injury until they're out of shock. And some of these guys respond dramatically, as I'm sure many of you have experienced. So his other life-threatening problem is his head trauma. We're going to have to leave the mandibular symphyseal fracture, and everything else should be put to the wayside, and we need to focus on these. Well, when we're talking about head trauma, there's two types of brain injury that occur. There's the primary brain injury and there's the secondary brain injury. The primary brain injury is what happens at the time of impact. This is something we cannot do anything about. This is the direct injury to the parenchyma and the blood vessels, and the damage is already done, and only time will tell if these neurologic problems are reversible. It's the secondary brain injury that we as veterinarians and veterinary technicians can focus on and hopefully reduce the amount of secondary brain injury that occurs in hopes to improve that neurologic outcome. Secondary brain injury results from secondary intracranial processes. So this is the inflammation that's happening from the primary injury, the edema, the vasculitis, as well as damage from increased intracranial pressure in and of itself. There are many causes of secondary brain injury, but hypoxemia and hypovolemia contribute to the depletion of ATP in the brain. This is bad because then you can get release of excitatory neurotransmitters, especially the neurotransmitter glutamate, which is kind of the evil neurotransmitter when it comes to head trauma. And this increases the cerebral metabolic oxygen demand, which is not a good thing when we're trying to prevent some of this secondary injury. If we have ischemia to the brain because of this increased cerebral metabolic oxygen demand, there's oxygen free radical formation can occur. You can also get lactate building up in the brain, and all of this ischemia damages brain cells further than they already were from the primary injury. So the primary goal of treating head trauma is to reduce the secondary brain injury. And one of the biggest things we have to do is restore oxygen delivery to the brain, because the brain cannot utilize glucose and ATP without oxygen. And if you don't have oxygen there, it's going to go down the anaerobic pathway and again lead to lactic acidosis in the brain, cell damage, and increased glutamate in the brain. We also need to decrease cerebral edema and intracranial pressure. So these three things, restoring oxygen delivery, decreasing cerebral edema, and intracranial pressure, are the three things that I'm going to focus on how we can do that in the head trauma case. In every head trauma case, I think it's very important to get a blood pressure, and I'll show you on the next slides as to why. But in this case, this cat was a little bit hypotensive with a mean pressure of 60. I also think it's extremely important to get a initial blood glucose on presentation, and we'll explain why. This particular cat had a blood glucose of 312. They absolutely need flow by oxygen, again, a way to increase our oxygen delivery to our brain. And then as far as IV fluid resuscitation, if they're in shock, fluid of choice would be to start with 5 mL per kilo of IV hetastarch over 15 minutes. And again, I'll explain why in the following slides. So we really want to maximize this oxygen delivery. So the first thing should be we just administer supplemental oxygen as soon as possible. This not only just maximizes oxygen in the blood and hopefully to the brain, but the brain wants oxygen. And if it's oxygen deprived, what it's going to do is dilate its vessels in its brain to maximize the blood flow to its brain so that it can maximize the amount of oxygen to its brain. But if you get cerebral vasodilation, you're actually going to increase intracranial pressure. So being hypoxemic, as most of these animals probably have pulmonary contusions as well, is going to worsen intracranial pressure. So if we just give them some flow by oxygen, hopefully we can prevent that rebound cerebral vasodilation and reduce intracranial pressure. We also want to maximize cerebral perfusion, because oxygen delivery is going to be not only the amount of oxygen in the blood, but it's also going to be how much blood is getting to the brain. So we want to maximize cerebral perfusion by treating shock and hypotension. We have to understand what cerebral perfusion is. Cerebral perfusion in general is the mean arterial pressure minus the intracranial pressure. Now it's important to recognize this, because you'll see why it's very, very important to treat the shock before we start treating the intracranial pressure. So we need to treat hypotension before treating intracranial pressure. And this is because if we normalize the mean arterial pressure, we're going to maximize the cerebral perfusion pressure. If we just focus on reducing the intracranial pressure and we don't ever raise this mean arterial pressure, you're never going to improve cerebral perfusion pressure. In fact, you're probably going to make it worse. So you need to focus on this mean arterial pressure as the first thing, and then once they're volume resuscitated and out of shock, then you can focus on reducing intracranial pressure with other means. I would target a mean arterial pressure of 80 millimeters of mercury. You don't want to overdo it, because if you overperfuse the brain, that's also going to affect cerebral perfusion or intracranial pressure, really. So I would try to target a mean arterial pressure of around 80 millimeters of mercury. So a lot of these animals come in shock. So what fluid should we use to help decrease cerebral edema yet increase blood flow to the brain? Well, we need fluids that quickly raise the blood pressure but do not contribute to that cerebral edema. And this concept is to reduce the amount of crystalloids that are given. So we want to reduce the number of lactated ringers or Norm-R that is being given. It has been shown, though, that even if you give crystalloid, it's okay because the addition of a colloid, regardless of how much crystalloid has been given, has been shown to be beneficial in head trauma. So there's been a lot of studies, and a lot of these have been in lab situations, but it's been shown that head of starch alone, 5 to 10 mils per kilo IV over 10 to 15 minutes as the resuscitation fluid for head trauma is one of the best resuscitation fluids and helps decrease cerebral edema while restoring that blood flow to the brain. A combination of head of starch and hypertonic saline is just as effective, if not slightly more effective, than head of starch alone. And typically, we use 2/3 of a head of starch with a 1/3 of 7% hypertonic saline combination. And then you give 3 to 5 mils per kilo IV over 10 to 15 minutes of that combination. You also can do that same combination with dextrans, so 2/3 dextrans with a 1/3 hypertonic saline, and it's been shown to be very effective. Some people think that dextrans is actually a better colloid because it actually has smaller molecules and may help improve microperfusion to the brain better than head of starch. We don't carry dextrans at CSU, so I tend to use head of starch more than dextrans. I will say that you should avoid hypertonic saline in and of itself without a colloid, because hypertonic saline alone has been shown to have negative outcomes in head trauma cases. But judicious use of crystalloids, especially if you're going to use colloids, is okay. Like, if you don't know if your owners have enough money to afford a colloid, and it's expensive in your hospital to use a colloid, don't hesitate to start resuscitating them properly with a crystalloid. It's very important to get them out of shock. So I tend to do what I call a quarter shock dose over 10 to 15 minutes, which ends up being about 22 mils per kilo in the dog or 15 mils per kilo in the cat, and I titrate it to effect. A lot of our head trauma patients also are pediatric patients. They're little puppies or kittens that have been stepped on or, slammed in a door by accident or dropped. And lactated ringers of all of the three main ones I think of are lactated ringers, Normasol R, and saline. Lactated ringers is great for neonates because it's been shown that they tend to use the lactate in lactated ringers as a better energy source than glucose. So there is some thought that LRS should be the resuscitation of choice for these head trauma patients as well as critical neonates. You don't need to do that in adults, though. So there's controversies. Some people might say, well, if I give a colloid, which is a very big molecule, and I give hypertonic saline, what if there's a massive intracranial bleed? Aren't these big molecules and the hypertonic saline going to leak out into that hematoma or hemorrhage area and actually pull more fluid into it and worsen intracranial pressure? And yes, it is a concern. We don't tend to do CTs on most of our head trauma patients, so we don't know if they have subdural hemorrhages or intracranial bleeds. Most of the time, we feel that there's probably only about 10% of patients that have massive intracranial bleeds that would probably have a worsened outcome with head of starch and hypertonic saline combinations, but it's something you really need to keep in mind, that as you're volume resuscitating these animals, are they getting worse or are they getting better? And if they're getting worse, you probably should stop your fluid therapy and reassess. And then the question comes in, and I don't know the answer to this, but do crystalloids truly contribute to cerebral edema? We think it does probably increase the amount of just local cerebral edema. It probably doesn't cause massive cerebral edema, but we definitely know in pulmonary contusion models that crystalloids will cause expansion of those contusions, and it's probably true within the brain as well. So when we're talking about, so that was about oxygen delivery to the brain. Now we want to reduce intracranial pressure. We have our mean arterial pressure at where we want it. Now we want to focus on that second part of the equation to reduce intracranial pressure. The only things that we can do to reduce intracranial pressure is to manipulate the blood vessels, the parenchyma, or the cerebral spinal fluid. Because the brain is in a cranial vault and it's a confined space, there isn't much we can play with when it comes to reducing intracranial pressure. And the easiest thing to focus on are the blood vessels and the parenchyma. So we want to reduce excessive cerebral vasodilation. And we talked about the restoring blood pressure to normal is actually going to decrease cerebral vasodilation because it's going to allow there to be proper oxygen to the brain, and so the brain's not going to be vasodilated because it's oxygen starved. Again, we want to prevent hypoxemia to the brain as well for those reasons, and we want to prevent hypoventilation because increased carbon dioxide causes cerebral vasodilation. So we want to avoid respiratory depressant drugs such as general anesthetics, heavy sedatives. There's a debate whether we should be using the pure opioids such as morphine or hydromorphone, which are more respiratory depressant than something like butorphanol or buprenorphine. But if you're using low doses of the pure opioids, it's probably okay. But it's really important to keep this in mind, especially if you have to anesthetize these animals, which hopefully you can avoid until they're in a better state. But you really need to make sure that they're ventilating normally, if not being mildly hyperventilated, to decrease intracranial pressure. Some other things you can do to reduce intracranial pressure is to avoid excessive blood flow to the brain. So raising the head 15 to 30 degrees, as long as there's no neck injury present, is very helpful in treating head trauma and is something that is easy to do, especially if they're not moving around a lot. And also trying to avoid putting pressure on the jugular veins. So avoiding jugular catheters and jugular draws in these guys, because putting pressure on those will decrease venous return from the head and increase the intracranial pressure. In addition, you want to avoid anything that causes temporary rises in intracranial pressures, such as coughing. And this is especially true if you have to intubate these guys, because during intubation, that's the most stimulating part of any anesthetic event when you're first getting them to go to sleep. So it's very important to prevent coughing and avoid intubation if possible. But if you do need to intubate them, giving the animal either a local anesthetic on their retinoids, like for a cat, or IV lidocaine at 1 to 2 mg per kg will decrease the cough reflex. We also want to, we focused on the vascular side of things to reduce intracranial pressure. Now we want to focus on the parenchymal side, and to reduce the parenchyma in the brain, we have to decrease cerebral edema. And this is where some of the controversy in treating head trauma comes in. Mannitol is kind of the treatment of choice when it comes to reducing intracranial pressure. It's an osmotic diuretic, and it has some other positive effects in head trauma. It's a free radical scavenger, so I said that those free radicals from hypoxemia in the brain actually can cause more secondary brain damage. So this would be great if we could scavenge some of those free radicals. It also decreases blood viscosity, which may help improve microcirculation to the brain. So it has all these positive effects, but there are some controversial uses. For one, if they're not properly volume resuscitated, then you could actually make them more hypovolemic and more hypotensive because it is an osmotic diuretic. It's also the same argument that we had for the colloid. For the hypertonic saline, if you have this really hyperosmolar molecule that leaks out into the hemorrhage area, isn't it going to draw more fluid into that hemorrhage? And that's probably true. And again, I've seen, about 10% of animals get worse with mannitol, and I would say about 90% of them get better or have no change. So you have to be really cautious when you're giving it. And the most common thing I see happen is they start to seizure as I'm giving them mannitol if there's an issue with it. There's also something called the rebound effect. So you suddenly give this really hyperosmolar substance, which is mannitol, and then you get all of this fluid getting drawn in from the interstitium into the vascular space. So all of a sudden your blood volume temporarily increases, and that's a temporary increase in intracranial pressure. Because of that, some people decide to give Lasix, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I don't like to give Lasix in the head trauma patient because I think it volume depletes them too quickly and they tend to get hypovolemic. But despite the controversy, the majority of head trauma animals do seem to respond to mannitol. I routinely give it after they're volume resuscitated. I tend to give a half to 1 gram over 20 to 30 minutes. And if you're really worried, you can start with a half a gram per kilo, and if there is improvement, then repeat it. If they start to seizure or neurologically decline, you stop it, and don't exceed 3 grams per kilo in 24 hours. If they have a positive response to like a gram per kilo, I'll probably give another gram per kilo every 8 hours for 24 hours, and hopefully that'll stabilize the amount of cerebral edema. So in this case, to summarize reducing intracranial pressure, we elevated this kitty's head 15 to 30 degrees to help decrease blood flow to the, or excessive blood flow to the brain. We gave it mannitol and observed for changes in mentation and considered repeating the dose if there was improvement, and then maintained normal ventilation. Wanted the kitty to not have a high CO2, so it's kind of hard to get an arterial blood gas in cats, but you can certainly use a venous carbon dioxide, and if it's normal, you know that they're not hypoventilating because the arterial side's always going to be lower than the venous side as far as CO2 goes. So you can use your venous CO2 to see if they're ventilating okay. Talking about that Lasix therapy, this may enhance the diuretic effect of mannitol and prevent the rebound effect that I was talking about when you first give it. The dose of Lasix is normally 1 to 2 mgs per kg IV, and there tends to be some controversy as to when to give it, before or after the mannitol. I tend to give it before the mannitol because that allows the volume depletion, and then you don't get that rebound effect. The neurologists at CSU tend to give it after the mannitol, so I don't really know which is the right way, but it makes more sense to me to give it before. You need to be cautious of causing volume depletion and return of hypotension, and I tend to avoid this in head trauma cases I mentioned, and this is just something that I tend to use for animals that are normal volemic but have really high intracranial pressure, such as brain tumor dogs or cats. Now, the steroid question always comes up. It's currently out of favor in emergency critical care in neurology specialties because there's been no improvement to outcome with head trauma, with steroids and head trauma. And in the human studies, they've actually showed worsened outcome. There was something called the CRASH study, which looked at this in people, and it showed a worsened neurologic outcome with steroid use with head trauma. So they're not using it anymore, and it may worsen hyperglycemia, which I'll talk about in a second. And it has only been shown to be useful prior to the head trauma injury, which normally we don't see them. Although I've been asked the question before, animals on chronic steroids, do they survive head trauma better? And I don't know the answer to that, but sometimes I wonder. Hyperglycemia is an interesting point about head trauma these days, because in people, the degree of hyperglycemia on presentation is correlated to not only the severity of the head trauma, but the outcome. So the higher the glucose, the worse the head trauma, the worse the outcome. In dogs and cats, one of my colleagues, Dr. Becky Syring, who's now at the University of Pennsylvania, she showed that hyperglycemia is correlated to the severity of head trauma in both dogs and cats. There's a higher range in cats because they can get a stress hyperglycemia anyway, but there is a degree of correlation with hyperglycemia and head trauma, but she did not find that it was associated with outcome. And I think that's partially because the what they use to measure success of head trauma in people is very different than what we use to measure success of head trauma in animals. We just need them to eat and drink and eliminate and sleep and interact appropriately with people, whereas people need to do higher math and talk and all of that. So I think that's probably where some of the difference came in. We don't know why the hyperglycemia occurs, but in head trauma cases, but we think it may be due to the severity of the catecholamine release. The problem with hyperglycemia is that it may be detrimental if the brain is hypoxemic, because brain lactate levels can be increased, you can get cellular acidosis from that, and ultimately cell death. We don't know whether we should control hyperglycemia associated with head trauma. We probably do need to be doing it. I have given insulin to some of these cases, there's been a lot of studies that have come out of the human field that tight glycemic control, keeping glucoses between 80 and 150 in critical patients, significantly improves outcome. And so whether that's true of head trauma patients, we don't know. We don't know if this is true in veterinary medicine, but I wouldn't be surprised if recommendations in the future talk about treating these with low-dose insulin until their glucose gets under control. Some future consideration would be to control glutamate levels in the brain. Glutamate is controlled by the NMDA receptor, which is what ketamine blocks. And so there's questions, maybe using these microdoses of ketamine may help. We know that anesthetic doses of ketamine increase intracranial pressure. So we don't want to use ketamine at anesthetic doses, but it has not been shown to increase intracranial pressure at the microdoses. Whether or not that helps or not in head trauma, I don't know. Magnesium is the natural blocker of the NMDA receptor in the brain. And so there is some question whether we should be putting these animals on supplemental magnesium in their IV fluids. The other question is should we decrease calcium levels in the brain? Because calcium is cytotoxic, and if we could block some of the calcium, we might decrease secondary brain injury. So there's question whether calcium channel blockers are going to come out in the future, but it doesn't look all that promising, and there's no studies to date on these theoretical treatments. As far as prognosis goes, we want to look at pupil size. Pinpoint is to mid-range dilated to fixed and dilated, goes from least worst to worst, obviously. We want to look at that initial blood glucose. If it's really high, it's probably a pretty severe injury. If it's normal, it's probably a mild injury. We want to, before we do prognosis, again, we need to make sure that the animal is out of shock. I would give the animal time. If the owners have the money to keep going, I would do a minimum of 24 to 48 hours. I've seen these animals turn around immediately in the 12 to 24 hour period, going from comatose to being able to walk in that time period. However, if they remain comatose over 48 hours, the prognosis is likely poor to grave. Some animals need weeks to months, maybe years to recover fully. But recovery, in my mind, should be, like I mentioned before, if they can eat, drink, eliminate, sleep, and interact positively with people. I will say that many of these head trauma patients will continue to eat and drink despite being in an obtunded state. And head trauma patients do need a lot of energy to repair themselves if their brain is injured. So my recommendation is to offer food and water early, as long as the gag reflex is intact and the animal can be propped up in a sternal position. You'll be very surprised. A lot of these puppies and kittens will still eat, and adults too, despite them not being fully aware. There's a very, in your proceedings, I have listed the modified Glasgow Coma Scale, which helps with prognosis. If you want to use this, it has been validated in the dog. It looks at motor activity, brainstem reflexes, and level of consciousness, and then it scores a number for each of those categories, and then you add them together. And if in the scoring, 3 to 8 is considered grave, 9 to 14 is considered guarded, and 15 to 18 is considered good. My recommendation for this is to simply just use it in conjunction with, you know, your experience and everything that is going on. In this case, if we looked at the motor activity, this kitty would get a 4 in motor activity, a 5 in brainstem reflexes, and the level of consciousness would be a 5. And a total score would be 14, which is a guarded prognosis, but it's at the high end of the guarded range. You know, 15 is considered a good prognosis. So if we had found an owner for this kitty and were able to convince them to keep going, then we probably would have in this case. I've seen some amazing head trauma recoveries. You know, in people, they give them years. And in veterinary medicine, it seems like we give them 2 days for some reason. And those people who are willing to go for it, I've seen comatose animals come around in 2-3 weeks and eventually become essentially normal animals. And again, in this case, the hyperglycemia of 314 is pretty mild for the cat. And the actual numbers can be seen in Dr. Syring's paper that she had published a couple years ago. Continue to support. I do oxygen, raise the head 30 degrees, fluid support, give them mannitol, consider nutrition, and also consider analgesics because of everything else that was going on with the cat. I get questioned whether we think we need analgesics even if there weren't any other injuries. You know, is the animal feeling pain with head trauma? And I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that they probably have a pretty good headache. So if you have the ability to give analgesics and be judicious about it, I think it's a good idea. So in summary, treat the shock and the hypotension, reduce the intracranial pressure, consider colloid hypertonic saline fluid therapy for resuscitation. Oxygen therapy and head elevation should be instituted on every case as long as there's not neck injury for the head elevation. Consider mannitol administration and give 24 to 48 hours before determining the ultimate prognosis on these guys. I have some questions, then I'll go on to the toxins. It's a good question. The question was, would I restrict the use of analgesics if I'm trying to neurologically assess the patient? I don't believe in withholding analgesics if the animal has a very painful condition. If in that situation, a lot of times I use a lot of constant rate infusions. So if I need to reassess the neurologic status, I'll use a short-acting opioid such as fentanyl, and I'll turn it off for about 20, 30 minutes and then do the neurologic assessment. It can interfere with your neurologic assessment, absolutely. But I think if you're using the low doses, which we probably should be using in these guys anyway, that it probably shouldn't horribly affect your ability to assess the animal. There's one other question. That's a good question. How do I feel about cooling the patient to decrease oxygen demand? They do that in people, especially after CPR. They pack their head in ice during CPR to help decrease cerebral metabolic oxygen consumption and slow the metabolic rate. And it's been shown to improve outcome. I don't routinely put ice on my CPR patients. I just don't think it's convenient. I do not aggressively warm these patients, though. If they're cold, a lot of times I'll let them be cold for a while I'm resuscitating them. And once I get the fluids on board and I get a better assessment, then I'll start to slowly rewarm them. I'm just not horribly aggressive about rewarming them for that reason, and it's an excellent point. Yeah, that's a great question, too. The question was, do I ever consider using oxyglobin in these cases? Oxyglobin is a very potent colloid. It's a stronger colloid than hetastarch. And although it theoretically increases oxygen delivery, some of the studies have shown that it really doesn't, but it improves oxygen perfusion because of its colloid effects. And it actually is a nitric oxide scavenger, so it causes vasoconstriction as well. So it increases blood pressure very quickly because of that. So oxyglobin would be a fine choice in resuscitation of these guys if you wanted to use it, but it's probably not that much different than using hetastarch or dextrans.
EMS
We're getting into all the controversies. DMSO use, people use it. It's a great oxygen radical scavenger, if you don't mind the smell. We don't know whether or not it helps in head trauma cases. I know some critical care colleagues of mine that still use it. And I've used it like in one or two cases of severe head trauma, but I don't use it routinely. I don't know of any studies to show that it's detrimental. Okay, let's move on to the last topic. This is a pretty quick little topic here on neurologic toxins. The 2-year-old female spayed lab presents for acute onset of ataxia and drunk appearance, polydipsia, and vomiting. So I wanted to just bring this up because we hear about the drunk dog a lot, and I think a lot of it comes to mind that, you know, it could be antifreeze. And I wanted to make you comfortable with ruling out antifreeze toxicosis. Ethylene glycol classically presents as ataxia, drunken appearance, polydipsia, and vomiting in the early stages. And you have to be able to recognize it and feel comfortable ruling it out, because if you miss it, the animal's dead. So, irreversible and fatal kidney failure is the result of untreated ethylene glycol toxicosis, and so it's imperative that you feel comfortable ruling it in or out. But lately, I've seen a lot of cases, especially being in Fort Collins, of marijuana toxicosis, because it actually presents almost identical to the early stages of ethylene glycol. It can cause ataxia, drunken appearance, polydipsia, and vomiting. And it occurred to me when I'd gotten called by numerous interns and residents who were so scared that they had an ethylene glycol dog, and I was trying to make them feel comfortable that the tests that they had run ruled out ethylene glycol. They still didn't believe me, and they still worried. And so I just wanted to kind of compare and contrast these two toxins. Obviously, the marijuana dog, the course is self-limiting and generally non-life-threatening, and treatment's usually supportive. But the problem is that a lot of the owners do not want to admit to the possibility of exposure. Some of them are in a state where they don't realize that they're admitting to it, but generally they don't want to admit to it. So we must rule out ethylene glycol to the best of our abilities. I will say that there are other neurologic toxins that present similar to these two. Barbiturates, tricyclic antidepressants, methanol, and alcohol also can present similarly. So a very thorough history is clearly very important. Questioning and re-questioning the owner, we've all heard that, you know, they say no, 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 and then all of a sudden, yes, there was some exposure when we're talking about ethylene glycol. The likelihood that the animal roams, as well as the time of year, may give some clues as to the likelihood of antifreeze. So one of the biggest things that we see, if there is ethylene glycol in the blood, we are going to have an elevated anion gap. The anion gap is just looking at the unmeasured anions in the body. So these are anions that we just don't normally measure. Well, to refresh your memory of what the anion gap is, it's the sodium plus the potassium minus the chloride plus the bicarb. Most emergency practices these days have point-of-care blood gas machines and electrolyte machines. If you don't have a machine that calculates the anion gap, you can easily calculate it yourself if you have the sodium, potassium, chloride, and bicarb. If the anion gap is elevated, so normal, it depends on if you're a dog or a cat, is like between 18 and 24. So when I'm talking elevated, I'm talking most of the ethylene glycol animals I've seen, the anion gap's up in the 40s. But if it's in the 30s, it should be concerning as well. This means that there's a presence of an unmeasured anion. Well, ethylene glycol isn't the only unmeasured anion out there. Lactate, ketones, salicylates like aspirin, and phosphorus all can increase the anion gap. So if the animal's in renal failure and has a high phosphorus, you're going to have an elevated anion gap. So if you have a means of measuring lactate, ketones, and phosphorus, salicylates, obviously we don't see that very often, and it's not easily measured, to rule out as those causes of unmeasured, of why the anion gap is elevated, and those things are normal, then you have to be highly suspicious of something like ethylene glycol in the blood. If ethylene glycol is circulating in the blood, it's also going to cause a metabolic acidosis. So if they are, you can use your venous blood gas to also look at this, and that should be another clue. In addition, ethylene glycol tends to cause a pretty significant ionized hypocalcemia, and that's another thing that you would want to look at. And again, I think a lot of emergency practices have the ability to look at ionized calcium these days. Something else you can look at, and most of you aren't going to have exposure or the ability to do this, is something called the osmolal gap. It's the difference between the calculated osmolality and the measured. The calculated osmolality of the blood takes into consideration sodium, glucose, and BUN. If you were able to measure the osmolality of the blood and compare it to the calculated, and the measured was a lot higher, especially greater than 10 milliosmoles per liter, then there is a presence of an unmeasured hyperosmolar substance, such as ethylene glycol. Mannitol also will increase the osmolal gap. So it's something that you're not going to have a lot of luck with, because you have to have a machine, an osmometer, to actually measure that. But we use this occasionally at the university to help us. You could do a urinalysis. If they have calcium oxalate crystalluria, then they're probably at least 6 to 12 hours into it. That usually isn't present until about 6 to 12 hours after ingestion. If they have isocyanuria and azotemia with calcium oxalate crystalluria, it's probably too late. It's a grave prognosis, and they'll likely need to be referred for dialysis if the owners are willing to go that far. There's the ethylene glycol blood test. The old test is a very cumbersome test, and it's useful if ethylene glycol is still circulating in the blood. There are some newer tests that have just come out that are like ELISAs and supposedly SNAP tests. We were supposed to be getting some at CSU, I've been on maternity leave for the last 3 months, so I haven't had a chance to use them at all, but I've heard that they're really useful compared to the old test, which was like test tubes and things like that, which is kind of crazy. You have to be aware that the use in cats and small dogs of these tests may not be sensitive enough to detect lethal amounts of ethylene glycol in the blood. So if you test a cat or a very small dog and it's negative, even in these newer tests, they still might have a lethal dose circulating in their blood, just the test isn't sensitive enough. In addition, propylene glycol and sorbitol cause false positive results. This is really important for the private practitioner to know, because if you don't happen to have 4-MP or fomepizole in your clinic in order to treat ethylene glycol toxicosis, then you need to not give charcoal that has sorbitol in it, okay? Because if you need us to test them and you don't have the test, then we can't interpret it if they've had activated charcoal, okay? So, feeling good about ruling out ethylene glycol. The history makes ingestion unlikely. They have a normal anion gap. There's no metabolic acidosis. They have a normal ionized calcium. They have a normal osmolal gap. They have no calcium oxalate crystalluria, and they have a negative ethylene glycol test. You should feel confident that they don't currently have ethylene glycol. If they're still drunk, they're probably not into the kidney failure stage. The kidney failure stage normally shows up 2 to 3 days later, and they're really rarely ataxic and drunk at that point. Well, what about marijuana? Can we get the information out of the owner? Again, sometimes not. Sometimes we can identify the substance in the vomitus if we make them vomit. And you might want to consider some of these new human urine drug test kits. So the test that we use at CSU is the MedImpex United Incorporated test. You can find them online. It's called the multi-drug 9-panel test kit. You can get different levels. You can get 3, 4, 5 tests. The cost is about $20 to the client, which is pretty good. It's not validated in the dog, and it unfortunately may cross-react with other drugs. Like, for instance, it measures amphetamines, but if they got into ephedra or something, it actually can cause that to be positive. The problem with this regarding marijuana is that we don't know how sensitive the test is or how long you need to wait after the ingestion for it to be positive, because we have had known marijuana dogs where the owners have absolutely confessed to the possibility of marijuana. The dog vomits, there's marijuana in the vomit, and we urine drug test them and they're negative. And I've on VIN, I've looked on the toxicology boards, and it seems to be a problem across the board. Of all of these urine drug tests, for some reason in the dog, the marijuana test is not very accurate. I don't know if it's metabolized differently or not excreted in the urine as much. So, and it also brings up some ethical issues about, you know, should we get the owner's permission before we do this drug test or not? This is what they look like. And you just dip the urine down here and it comes up, and if there's no line, it's positive. So it looks at cocaine, amphetamine, methamphetamine, THC, which is marijuana, methadone, opioids, PCP, barbiturates, and benzodiazepines. And this dog came in to me in closing here. This was kind of humorous. And he could not focus. This was a true neurologic emergent. I mean, he was just all over the place. He was like, you try and call his name, and he would just like look around. And I think I pan in on his eyes at some point, and you see how incredibly dilated they are. He's a little bit shaky and looking around. Strangely enough, his owner looked exactly the same way. And I couldn't get him to focus. You can see how dilated his eyes are. And finally, I said, "Can I just do some urine for some drug tests?" And at the time, I don't think he cared what the drug tests were for. And he said, "Yeah, he very likely could have gotten into something." And that's what you saw. And there he is walking. He's just still just. What's going on? He's so hyper. This is the positive amphetamine, methamphetamine right here of that dog. And so it was really nice to have this drug test, because in the past we didn't have that ability. I've only been using this test for about 2 years, and I'd be like, gosh, I don't know what this dog got into. Could it be something really bad? Is it something that's going to go away? And this was just a nice peace of mind for me to know that the dog was going to recover with supportive care and be fine in a few hours. And when the owner came back to get the dog, he also was fine. So... seemed to wear off about the same rate. I guess I can't say 100% it was methamphetamines. Again, it's cross-reactivity. I don't know. Maybe the dog got into ephedra or something like that. So in summary, as far as the toxicosis goes, ruling out ethylene glycol toxicosis is imperative. Early detection is life-saving. Missing the diagnosis is deadly. Understanding the tests that should be run is necessary for proper diagnosis. And the availability of illicit urine drug testing has allowed for more accurate diagnosis of these suspected drug cases. So with that, are there any further questions? Yes. Yeah, so the question was, if you have an ethylene glycol dog that comes up negative at your hospital and you're still worried about, could you send it in to a human hospital and have them run it? Yes, you probably could. We used to do a test on our chemistry analyzer that detected, I don't remember the units, it's less than 50, whatever it was, isn't detectable with our little lab test that we have. And so our machine actually detected it as low as zero. Like, you could get any level of ethylene glycol from zero to 50 or higher. And then our clinical pathologist told us it wasn't validated, and we didn't know if it was really real or not, and that sorbitol and propylene glycol still interfered with that lab test. So I don't know. I guess you'd have to check with your individual human hospital and make sure, but I think it's a possibility. Right. Right. Right, because if you happen to have a dog that got Valium, which has propylene glycol in it, or charcoal with the sorbitol in it, and you run the ethylene glycol test and it's positive, and then you're like, oh my gosh, do I need to go ahead and treat this dog or not? And so then it gets really tricky. But I will say that, again, if you have a normal anion gap and no metabolic acidosis and no ionized, no low ionized calcium, you're probably okay. But again, it's still like that, oh, I'm scared, you know. And sometimes I give the owners the option, you know. They're like, you know, well, how much does the treatment cost? Well, it's really expensive, but some people want to just do it to be safe. We had a case that was on the edge. The osmol gap was 10. You know, the ethylene glycol test was positive, but he came in for a GI obstruction and needed surgery. And his anion gap was high, but he had a lactic acidosis as well, so we didn't know how much of that was contributing to lactic acidosis. And they saw a few calcium oxalate crystals in the urine. We didn't know what to do, so they were going to surgery anyway, and we treated them also. So, I don't know. Sometimes it's hard. I think it's better to be safe than sorry. If it was my dog, I'd treat. Any other questions? Well, thank you for your attention. Enjoy your evening.